This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Seat One Podcast. I am back. This is Ben, aka Boston Nuga. It's been a couple weeks. I went to Disney World, which was an experience. I will say that no place on the face of this earth has a way of making you part with your money, unlike the Disney Company. They are very talented in that regard. They have a way to just make you willingly hand it over, just in fistfuls, basically, and you're happy to do so. But my daughter had a wonderful time. We did the, if you go to Disney, you basically need a Sherpa for all the fast passes. But if you go with a little kid, you can still have a really good time and not necessarily go on all the big rides. I will say this, the lines at Disney, I know everyone talks about them. There was one line for one ride at one point that was 225 minutes long. Hard pass on that. And I have a friend who worked at Disney said, oh yeah, no, there were seven hour lines for some rides when I first started working there. How do people do that? I don't understand it. I don't get it. Why do you waste your time at Disney waiting in line? It completely boggles the mind. I love roller coasters, but I don't love roller coasters to sit in a line for 3 hours. I don't love roller coasters to sit in a line for 7 hours. So that is not my idea of a good time. We still had a really good time though. If you guys look at my Twitter, you'll see a million pictures of me with my daughter and the whole family, and we just we had a great time. The Bippity Boppity Boutique, if you have a young girl, it is wildly expensive, but it is well worth it because your kid will grin like she's never grinned before. Or if you have a boy, they were doing little pirate makeovers too. So I will not just restrict that to girls there. But anyways, on with the show. I am very excited this week. I have a dear friend on, but also one of those people who falls into that most interesting man in the world category things, because every time I talk to him, I find out like five cool things that he did in his past and does in his present, and I'm just completely in awe of the life this man has lived. I have John Keating, or John M. Keating, if you're looking on IMDb. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. That cracks me up because, like, I just think of myself as the most boring person on the planet.
No, you're a fascinating. We've had conversations about this. You're a fascinating dude. You've done and seen things that none of us probably will ever do and see, and we'll get into that.
That's probably just because I'm so old.
Because you know, yeah, and you still have your dashing good looks, and I hate you for it.
Yeah.
But no, John. John, you are from my neck of the woods. You are from the Boston area. You grew up in Woburn, right? Or
correct.
Yep. Okay, sure.
Yeah, and I went to school in Salem, right by where you grew up.
Oh, two towns over from me. Yeah, and actually, I think we talked about this too. Yes. Salem. Salem's interesting this time of year, isn't it, John?
It's the best. It really is. If you're gonna go, this is the time to go. It's funny though. If you talk to people, I have a friend that runs a food tour through Salem, mm-hmm. like a walking tour. You go to different restaurants and craft places, and it's really fun, but they don't like to talk about that. They consider it's like the unpleasantness.
I hated it. I absolutely hated it because the tourists, I couldn't get anywhere. You know, I had an MMA gym that was about 5 miles from my house on the other end of Salem, and it would take me literally 45 minutes to an hour to get there in the month of October just because of all the tourists. And because Salem, there's one road in, there's one road out.
Yeah, exactly. And Salem State is a commuter school, so
and there's no parking.
You know, I was driving that all the time. It was not fun.
But you grew up in the Boston area. Now one the reason I got to know you basically is because you are a devout wrestling fan. So let's talk
devout. Much more devout than I am a Catholic. Yes.
So let's talk first about kind of how you fell in love with wrestling, because you probably had a similar background to me, maybe a few years ahead. But You probably had the same stations, everything that I had, and a lot of the same sort of stuff that I grew up on. But what did you grow up on as far as being a wrestling fan?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it was weird. I was going to visit my grandparents in Florida. They would go down to Florida for like a month or two or whatever during the winter. And I was going with my parents, and my mom bought me some magazines to read on the plane, and a couple of them were wrestling magazines because she thought I would like them. And I just kind of got like hooked on this, and I really got hooked on it through the magazines first. And it just became very like I would just read about these exotic places like Memphis, you know? Oh my God, they're busting people's testicles down in Memphis.
Memphis is exotic, but for different reasons than you think.
For different reasons, exactly. And then in August of 85, they surprised me and got me tickets to the Boston Garden. And it was the main event was, it was Hulk Hogan versus Big John Studd. Oh. And I was sick to my stomach for at least a week or two. Oh, totally. Yeah, totally work great. I'm sure there was a couple of bear hugs in there. And but I was sick to my stomach like a week or two before it because I was afraid that Hulk Hogan was going to lose the title and I was going to be there to see it. Like it would be my fault. But an interesting thing about that show was it was Randy Savage's first show in Boston. So it was his debut. So I had no idea who he was. And it was, you know, he comes out with the robe and just the energy. And I'm sitting up in the balcony area, and he just lit up the place, and no one really knew who he was.
Well, yeah, because you didn't, I mean, you were a kid, but I mean, did you get other TV? Did you soon get into other TV, or was it just straight WF?
I think the first TV
education
I really saw was World Class.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Because World Class had this thing in Boston. They did the Manning Bowl and Lynn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember seeing one of my first memories was the strap match, the Freebirds Von Erich strap, the leather strap match, and the welt on Terry Gordy's back. Oh, and I was like, this has to be real. Like, how does that – you can't fake that. Like, how does that – you know, because you'd hear all – is it real? Is it not real? And I never – it was like a magician. You never quite knew where it was what was planned, what wasn't planned, or how they did it, you know. And but yeah, so that was really the first TV wrestling I really saw, and then I started watching the WWF one. But what I really got into was the 605 show, the TBS show. And my grandparents had TBS. We didn't have it in Woburn; it wasn't on our cable package. And I would go over there on Saturday nights. We would go to church, the 4 o'clock mass, which is a very Boston Catholic.
It's a very Boston tradition. Yes, it's I want to drink on Saturday and I want to be hungover on Sunday. So let's get this over with at 4 in the afternoon on Saturday.
Let's get it over with right in the middle of the day. Always packed, and then we'd get dinner and we'd go back to their house and I would watch. You know, World Championship Wrestling on WTBS. So those were mostly the wrestling that I would watch. But I would, you know, every once in a while, it was so weird in the 80s. Like every once in a while, a UHF channel would just show like Mid-South for like 4 weeks. And then it would just disappear. Like you would see it, and like or it would just come on, like AWA would come on at weird times. And then it would just disappear. You know, it was such a weird time to be a wrestling fan.
Now, were you aware? I mean, because you said you kind of fell in love with the magazines. Were you one of those magazine guys where you're just like, you know, keeping up on everybody all across the country, or was your consumption limited to what you saw on TV?
Well, the consumption was limited to what I saw, but my interest was in all of it. It was just like anytime someone was coming in to WWF or NWA Crockett more so, but. And I read about them in the magazine. It was like a big deal. Like, oh, I'm finally going to get to see this person. You know, they didn't always live up to what they were going to be.
Yeah,
but.
they work New York, and then they slow their pace down by about 50%. The Hacksaw
Although
Jim Duggan rule.
Oh yeah, Duggan, man. He's one of those guys. I put him, Slaughter, and Ken Patera all together. Where these are guys that were amazing and great. Until just one day they weren't anymore. They were just like the switch flipped and they were just like, I'm done. This is it. We're out.
They just learn how to drive the car in third gear and they're just going to keep it in third gear the whole time.
And that's it. Yeah. If they're lucky, if third gear is as much. But I one of my favorite things from the garden, from, because I would go, my parents were divorced, so my dad would take me and my sister once a month. It was like, you know, it was like the big thing. We'd go and stay over his house. And but I got him to take me to, later on that same year in 85, Roddy Piper was doing a live Piper's Pit, and I was a big Roddy Piper fan. And it was with Bruno Sammartino, and it kicked off a 4-month storyline that was only done in the house shows. It was only done in Boston, Madison Square Garden, and I think Philly. I think, but it was just those three markets. And it started with the Piper's Pit, and then there was a brawl, and Orton got involved. And then there was a one-on-one match the following month, and then Orton got involved in that. So Bruno recruited Orndorff the following month, and they had a big schmoz. And then the final show, which is up on, and a lot of these may be up on the network. I know the final show definitely is.
The cage match?
The cage match, yes. Exactly, where he comes out with
the Bears jersey?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And he puts the posters on the cage. That was also the same show that Randy Savage won the IC title.
And you were there for that?
Yes. Yeah. Ridiculous. I'd never seen a title change. Like, it was, I mean, back then it was so rare that it blew my mind. It was like, because you didn't know it was coming, and all of a sudden it was like you were waiting for it to get reversed, and it wasn't. That whole card was really good.
Now,
sorry.
I have to say, I've talked to my father and my grandfather about Bruno in Boston, and you might have been too young to sort of remember how big the pops were, but Bruno in Boston was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was a god.
Because the Boston Garden was right on the edge of the North End, which is like Boston's little Italy, as you know.
Yeah.
So it was that. And my mom was a big Bruno fan. And she loved Bruno Sammartino. Even then, even if you watch these shows, the pop for him is gigantic. Like, unlike anybody else.
Yeah, I've said this before, the one best Christmas present I ever got from my dad was a Bruno autograph. My dad just like treasures it, because like, and this was, God, 7-8 years ago at one of the, I think, WrestleMania in Atlanta, he did a signing. But just like the reverence they speak about this man, you know, because we're Italian and you're Italian too, right?
Sure.
So like the reverence they speak about him just being this Italian hero was just,
and he really was. I mean, he's like, talk about the American dream.
Oh,
right?
Survived
like,
the Nazis. Yeah.
I mean, he's the living embodiment of that, of an American dream that I don't even know really if it exists anymore. Yeah. You know, like, it just, like, he came from literally hiding from Nazis in the hills and sick and almost dying to coming here and becoming this legend. And I mean, it's a story. It's a real story.
I wish someone I knew in the movies could make the Bruno movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Rumored 87 times.
Were they trying to make it at one point?
They tried to make it 15 times.
Yeah, and I heard he doesn't want
a dozen different screenplays and all that, and it's
I think he might have been tough to. I think he only wanted it. I have a feeling that people that wrote it wanted to spice it up somewhere, and he probably didn't want to.
He was so straight laced.
Stray from it at all or anything like that.
So straight laced, and so you. Did you continue to like stay on? Were you one of those? Because I'm always interested in this. Like, did you become lapsed once you became interested in girls and sports and stuff like that, or have you just been going all the way through?
You know what's weird? I've never really been into sports. I'm a big baseball fan, but I've never been a huge sports fan overall. I played everything. I wrestled. I played everything except for football. But my dad was a big athlete. He was a really great athlete. My sister's a really great athlete. But I was never, it just was never my passion. I always was more into like creative stuff, like acting and comedy. And wrestling I liked because it was, I can go play baseball, but I can't do that. I can't, you know, I can't do what they're doing. So, but I kind of fell out of it. I still watched it all the time. And I fell out of it. Then when ECW started coming in, I got really back into it.
Yes.
And because that also coincided with the internet, really, with, you know, 94, 95, Prodigy and AOL and all those, the message boards and stuff that really kind of coincided with all that stuff. And it got me back into it.
Yeah. ECW way. On the Spanish channel at midnight after the WWF show. Like, that was, you know, like I joked, you know, it's not like I really had many dates, so I was definitely home with Saturday night on midnight.
Yeah, no, it was weird. I would tape that. Yeah, when, and then that was another one. It would show for a while, and then it would disappear, and I would end up getting tapes from my friend in Philly, and or he was originally from Philly, and then that's how I really watched it, was through tapes from him.
Now, you actually started going to some of those famous ECW shows, from what you told me, correct?
Yeah, the very first one I went to, it was one of those Tom Misnick bus trips or whatever. You know, like you'd go down there, and there was supposed to be two shows. The first show got snowed out, so everybody just kind of hung out at the hotel, the famous Econo Lodge there.
Oh, God.
yeah, and the second night was CyberSlam 96, which is the one where Brian Pillman had his big surprise debut.
You were at that?
It also was the famous, which was held up until probably about like 2006, of the best match I ever saw live, which was Sabu versus Too Cold Scorpio in like a 30-minute draw.
Oh, nice.
Then there's a famous clip where Sabu jumps out of the ring and like obliterates a table in the crowd, and you can see me like right with my Dutch boy haircut, you know, my 90s floppy do, you know, and flannel. I'm sure I had flannel on because that's what you did.
That's what you did. It was the 90s, of course. That's what you did.
But we went back a couple other times. We saw the one that the doctor is in, the one that Steve Dr. Death Williams was Tommy Dreamer's tag partner.
Oh, sick.
And I was at the first pay-per-view. I went down for the first pay-per-view. That was really cool. To be there live for that. And then I was at the infamous, I was living in Revere at the time, and ECW was coming to Wonderland. It was right up the street from where I lived. I was so excited. We went,
R.I.P.
and that was the mass transit thing. That was the night of the mass transit thing, which was horrific.
Well, yeah, talk about the mass transit, because you're the only person I know who was actually at that mass transit show. Tell me everything you remember about that show, because that is legend.
Yeah, I mean, it almost cost them the company and mm-hmm. the pay-per-view, right? I mean, yep. I was there. I was there with my mom and my stepdad as well. And because they like wrestling and stuff. So we're like, oh, we'll go. And then my friend Rich, who was the guy that I would go down to ECW with, and his wife at the time. And so we all went. And I remember he came out, you know, as this big, heavy kid, dressed up like a bus driver, like Ralph Cramden from the Honeymooners. There's a nice current reference for you. And but we were joking, like me and my friend Rich were joking, like, oh, it's the biggest boss man, you know, like we're just like, whatever, he's this big fat kid. We figured he's just gonna lose. And then New Jack came out and just started beating on him, and the crowd was, you know, into it. But then it was one of those things where you go, this is going too far, and the crowd started getting weird. And he started hitting him with the X-Acto knife, right? And then just blood pouring out, like there was a puddle of blood in the ring. Like, oh. It was, the place got silent. It got silent.
Oh God!
I've never seen this much blood. It was insane, and it was like, it was literally like shooting. You know, like every pulse beat was it would kind of bubble, you know, would come out. Oh. and it was just the place got like seriously like deathly silent, and it was, and no one knew what to make of it. Like, is this can't be part of it, you know? And then people from the locker room started coming out, and I think Tommy Dreamer was one of them, and they got him out of there and stuff, and then they carried on with the show after. But it was just
carried on with the show after.
Oh, yeah. That was not the last thing.
There with
was
the puddle whole, in the ring?
Probably about. I'm sorry?
With the puddle of blood in the ring?
Well, they
well, I know, but the blood's stained.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, oh. That was, yeah. Yeah.
So I didn't realize. I thought they stopped the show. I didn't realize they went on with the show. I was on the.
They paused the show, but it didn't stop. Not to my recollection, no.
Jesus. Paul Heyman, man.
Yeah, it was rough.
Paul Heyman. Now, did you ever have any encounters? Because you were a traveler, you know, to all these shows. Did you have any encounters outside of the ring with any of these wrestlers, or get to know any of them?
No. I never knew any of them. I that night where the show got snowed out that first time before CyberSlam, a bunch of them hung out at the hotel and stuff, and I was just chatting with some, you know, but I was probably this obnoxious little, you know, what was it, 96, so I was like 24 or something like that. I was this obnoxious kid with a thick Boston accent, and so they were probably just happy to get away from me. But yeah, I like to, if I'm going to be a fan of something, I like to be a fan.
Sure.
I like to, you know what I mean? There's certain things that I obviously with acting and with stand up, I got behind the curtain because I wanted to get involved in it. But like stuff like that I do as a pastime, I just like to be a fan of it and just let people have their own life, you know, especially wrestling. Like I like to keep some of the mystique.
That's fair. Yeah. I wish I didn't know what I knew, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, seriously, like I was so, I think I got like a wrestling newsletter because I was getting pro Wrestling Illustrated and stuff like that. And then one day in the mail, I got like this newsletter. It was called like the Wrestling Tribune or something like that. And they must've got my name off of some kind of mailing list. And I read it and I was like, oh my God, this is like, this tells you how stuff is done and like what is, you know, and it was like a news, it was like an Observer or whatever. And then I got more into, I found the Torch and I found the Observer through that. But now it's kind of like, there was something about, I mean, it's cool knowing the business, but there was something about Sabu and not knowing, like I couldn't picture Sabu hanging out at his house watching Seinfeld,
yeah,
you know?
That's fair. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You know, like I don't know, and I didn't want to. Like he existed when he came through the curtain, and then whatever happened after that, I didn't need to know. Yeah.
Now you brought up, you know, comedy and acting, and
yeah.
This is a weird question. At what point did you realize you were funny? At what point did you realize I want to pursue this comedy thing? Because comedy was something you first took an interest to and really started to take seriously. Correct.
Yes, I did the senior play and stuff for high school, and I did a play in high school, and I had a comedic role in it, and I was funny in that, and I was like, oh, that's cool, that's nice, I like that, that's fun to get laughs like that. And then when I was in college, I was always a big stand-up fan, I was always a big comedy fan, I was a big Marx Brothers fan, I loved Monty Python. I would, you know, as a little kid, I would always beg my parents to stay up late for like the Tonight Show and watch the stand-up comics. They were my favorite part of like Star Search and all that stuff. So I was doing, it was like a cable access sketch comedy show in Revere. And oh, cool. I had met some friends at Salem State, which I never graduated. I still need to go back someday and finish that. So we were doing that, and then through them, I met someone that was friends with Lenny Clark, and his brother owned Giggles, and I'd always wanted to do stand-up. I would go to the shows at the Kowloons, and there was just one night, I was just like, I think I can do this. Like, I think I can, like, having written some sketches and stuff, I'm like, I think I can put together 5 minutes. And I went, and he put me up on this charity show that was taking place at Giggles on Route 1 in Saugus.
And this is Lenny Clark, who's been in everything. He's that guy from Boston, basically. If you guys don't know who Lenny Clark
exactly.
is, you've seen him. You know who he is. The name may not ring a bell, but he's been in everything as that Boston guy.
Definitely. Yeah, he had a big part in Rescue Me, if you watch that on FX. Dennis Leary's Fireman Show.
Kind of looks like Bill Parcells.
Yes, totally. And he's the warmest, sweetest guy you've ever met.
That's
like,
what I've heard.
Like, his stage persona, that's him. He's just the warmest, sweetest human being ever. And his brother owns Giggles, the comedy club. And so they put me on. I did, like, 5 minutes, and it went pretty well. I was at a stage where my material was way ahead of my stage presence at that time. I was a good writer, and it took me a little while to catch up on stage to be able to deliver it well. But I got, the other comics seemed impressed. One of the comics said, hey, you want to come open for me on this gig up in Maine? And I made $50 to drive him up to Maine. Same as wrestling, right? That's kind of, if you're okay to drive in a car with for multiple hours and you're not a pain in the ass, people will throw you $50 or whatever to open for them or to, you know, to work with them or work on the show or whatever, you know.
That should be the top of your resume, not a pain in the ass.
Junkie. You're not a fan of the ass. But it's a big deal. You don't want to be one of those comics that's bouncing material off people all the time, you know? Because if you shut up and listen, and similar to wrestling, if you just shut up and listen, if you're a newer guy, you're going to learn a lot more on those car rides. You know, and that's where I learned so much, because the other comics would, you know, they'd say, oh, you know, this was good, or this wasn't, or they would just tell stories. And you just learn a lot, you know. One of the worst things I always found you could do, and I hate it when people would do it with me. They go, hey, could you watch my set? And I'm like, sure, but do you want me to really critique your set, or do you want me just to tell you how great you are? Because I could just do that and go get a beer, and I'll be fine, you know. But if you just shut up and listen, and realize you don't know everything and you don't really know anything at that point. You really learn more from having a bad set and then riding home with a veteran comic than you do by going and killing in front of 100 people, you know.
Sounds very wrestling, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So
definitely
from there you just kind of start touring around with comics, and I know this was what, like late 90s?
Yeah, I started the first time I did that show was in 92. And I started, like, the class of comics that I started with was Dane Cook started, like, a couple of years ahead of me in Boston. Patrice O'Neill was starting around that time. Patrice, I did a couple of road gigs with him opening. What a brilliant comic he was. He was just so good. Like, really one of the best stand-up comics I've ever seen.
He was just so underrated.
Have jokes. It wasn't even jokes. Yeah. It was just him talking and just he was funny.
And former WWE writer for an hour.
That's right. Yes, that's true. That's right. Right, like around 2002, 2004, somewhere around there. Bill Burr was started right around the same time.
Love Bill Burr.
Yeah, Bill's great. And Gary Gulman, who has an HBO special right now, he started maybe a year or two after me. So that was like the group of guys. And I was one of the first comics in Boston to go on the road. As far as like to clubs, because you could work in Boston. I did a lot of colleges. That was where I made most of my money. You didn't really have to travel outside of New England. You could just, you know, but I would go to Cleveland and do the improv there, and the Buffalo Funny Bone and the Funny Bone in Evansville, Indiana. And I got to work with some really cool. Like I opened for Dave Chappelle and that was a lot of fun.
Chris Titus. What was Chappelle like?
Chappelle was really nice. His crowds are awesome because they're good comedy crowds. You know, he's such a great comic. He's stoned and he's nice. You know, he's not. You know, he's friendly, but he's not going to hang out with you. But sure. That's fine. You know, you learn the boundaries of like how you know there are certain headliners that I would hang out with. But there are a lot that you just kind of like, yeah, just give them their space. You know, same with acting. Yeah. You learn, you know, who you can talk to on set and who you just kind of get to give your space to. But I ended up because of my college bookings. I was booked by a company, Don Law Agency in Boston, which they used to do a lot of concerts. And then Clear Channel bought them, and then I got a gig opening for Bare Naked Ladies, which I was a big fan of Bare Naked Ladies. I like them anyway. So I got to open for them in Connecticut. This was around 2002. Yeah, and they were it's a funny story because Dido called in sick. So I got called. Yeah, she called in sick. It was supposed to be Dido, Guster, and Bare Naked Ladies.
If you've been to a show in Boston, Guster has played at it.
Yes, they're great. They're a great Boston band, Austin Rock City. Yep. You know, they're a great Boston band. And so they asked me if I wanted to do, my agent called me, she's like, you like Bare Naked Ladies, right? I'm like, yeah, no, they're great. She's like, do you want to do like 20, 30 minutes to open the show? Dido called in sick. So I was like, what? Okay. So they're like, oh, do you need a limo? And I was like, I'll drive myself. I'm good. Thanks. That was weird. They're like, they can either pay you a little more or give you a limo from Boston. And I'm like, I'll drive down from Boston and you can just pay me a little more. That's fine. And it was one of their Christmas like charity shows they do for like Toys for Tots and stuff like that. But it was about, I think it was about 8,000 people. So that's the biggest crowd I've ever played in front of. And it went great. It was really great. They were super nice. I got a picture. I'll post it up on Twitter after of me with them. And they even invited me on stage to sing the encore with them, which was Do They Know It's Christmas?
Cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And there, I got to find the sound bit, but I have someone gave me a bootleg of the tape of the show, and they're riffing on. They're like, you know, Dido didn't look as hot as I was expecting her to look. She just looked like a normal college kid, you know. So, and they gave me a nice shout out during their set and stuff. So it was a lot of fun. It was great. That was a great experience.
Now, did this parlay itself into opening for other musical acts as well?
Right around that time, I had opened for Weird Al Yankovic twice up at the Club Casino in Hampton, New Hampshire.
What a genius.
The famed Club Casino. Yeah. And he was great. I met him briefly. He's one of those guys you just kind of give their space to. But the crowds were great. I had two really great shows with him. And I opened for Alan Jackson, the country music singer, who I was not... I know, it's weird. I'm like, okay, because I was a pretty clean comic, but I did do some stuff about being Catholic and growing up in religion, and the sets went really well. But I got complaints after. The agent called me and said, "Hey, did you change your act or something?" And I was like, "No, why?" And she goes, "Oh, because we got some complaints that you were doing some inappropriate material." And I was like, it could have been the Jesus stuff, I guess, maybe, I don't know. But you know, I was like, I thought it was pretty innocuous. You know, it was just a joke about I moved in with my grandparents, and it was my mom's old room, and there was a giant crucifix on the wall still, and it was like slightly bigger than the one they hung Jesus on. And I wanted to move it, so I took it down, but the wall hadn't been painted since my mom lived there. So instead of the cross, there was now like the glowing image of the cross on my wall, you know. So it was like a sign from God in my bedroom. So I was like, that was kind of like the bit. So I was doing that. So I'm like, maybe that, but I wasn't dropping any F-bombs or anything. So, but who knows? Who knows what people will find offensive?
So what is life like on the road? That's, you know, for I mean, because I talk to wrestlers and I can imagine it's kind of a close cousin, but you know. Does it get old after a while? Do you enjoy every gig? I mean, how is the grind?
I always enjoyed the gigs. I don't do stand up anymore. I haven't really done stand up since 2007. The only thing I ever miss about it is the shows. I always enjoyed the gigs, even ones that weren't great. I did not like the business of stand up. I didn't like hanging out at the clubs. I got along. I have a couple of comics that are really good friends of mine. I didn't get along with a lot of comics. There's just a personality thing that I just couldn't jive with. There's a lot of negativity, a lot, you know.
Well, they're kind of by definition pretty, miserable people in a lot of regards.
They can be
working their shit out.
I mean, I know a lot of really, really funny comics who are not very funny or fun to hang around. And I will not name names, but they can be. Because there is that darker side. You're looking at that. You're examining that darker side of yourself a lot of times with stand-up.
Who are some of the comics that were great to hang around?
I'm sorry?
Who are some of the comics that we might know that were really great to hang around or were really good people and, you know?
Well, Lenny Clark, yeah. Like saying that. I mean, he was fantastic. A lot of the guy, Brian Regan.
Oh, yeah.
Super sweet. And just a genius of a comic. Jake Johansson. Really great comic. His special, this will take about an hour, his HBO special was one of the things that made me go, I want to do stand-up. Like, it was so, like, it just really spoke to me. That was a big, that was a special, I think it was like in the 90s, right before it started. And if you can find that special anywhere, it was really great.
Sure.
He was really great. I'm trying to think. I did some body doubling stuff for Jimmy Kimmel, and he's really nice. And everybody at his show is really nice. So
at a certain point, you decide to pack up and move to LA.
Yes, in 2002.
To live the dream.
Yeah.
To live the dream.
I'm living the dream.
What went into that decision? Talk about how scary that was or what the reception was and sort of the early days in LA.
Sure. I was working... I didn't have a day job for the longest time in Boston. I was just doing stand-up. And then a friend of mine had a job at this video game company. It was basically what what Steam does now, but way back then, before super fast internet. But it was renting games over the internet, and they were looking for people that knew gaming and stuff that they called them profilers. You would basically map the data in the game so it would know what to take first, so it would know what to download first. You basically play through the game and make sure you mapped out all the stuff that could possibly happen in those first moments and stuff. So I was doing that for, and it was a great gig. It was full time. I was getting benefits and I could still do stand up at night. And I was like, this is kind of cool. And then I got laid off. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to, maybe now I should start looking at moving out to LA. Cause it's one of those things that if you're a comic in Boston, LA or New York, it's always in it's always on the horizon. And it's kind of hard to leave because you're working a lot. You're known. You can be like a bigger fish in a smaller pond. But there's definitely a ceiling in Boston. There's a level of headliners for comics that you're not going to really bust into that. They've been like Steve Sweeney and Lenny Clark and Don Gavin and Tony V and these guys who are great comics. But they're going to be the headliners in Boston, and that's who people want to see. And it's almost like you need to kind of be the farm boy that goes off to the big city and makes it big and then comes back and marries the princess, you know?
Sure.
Because you need to go away, basically. Kind of, again, going back to wrestling, they would do that with a lot of younger wrestlers. I know, like, Bill Watts would talk about it with Mid-South. Like, you're not going to be a star if you stay here. You need to go away and come back. And that and Boston was very much like a small territory for stand-up comedy. And that that was very much present. And I had been doing some acting, and I had been studying, and I've always wanted to be an actor. It was always a thing that I wanted to do. I think even now I realize I think I wanted it even more than stand up, even though stand up was always a huge dream of mine as well. And so I was just like, okay, well, I think I'm gonna put my money aside. I'm gonna work out this summer, and then I'm gonna go. I was originally supposed to go on September 11th, 2001.
Oh, wow.
And that flight was always the one I would normally take if I would go to L.A. But then I got into the Comedy Central Laugh Riot. It was like the competition they were doing. And so I didn't book tickets. I didn't do anything like that. And then that happened. And then my plans got pushed back even further. And I ended up going out there I think it was around maybe in January of that year, and I looked for a place with a friend of mine who was moving out, and then I moved out in February of 2002. I had a little heat on me. I had some big agencies like Gersh and stuff interested in me when I first moved out. I was like the hot new comic, in. But then it just kind of nothing really came of that, and it just kind of fizzled. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, what do I do now? So I kind of stumbled around. I would go back to Boston a lot doing stand-up, and I'd be on the road. And I kind of came to the decision around, like, 2004 or so, like, if I'm going to be out here, I need to be out here. So I started getting into a class. I studied with Dee Wallace Stone, who was Dee was the mom in E.T., and she was in Cujo The Frighteners. Yeah, she's a huge actor in the 80s and 90s and stuff. And she's still working tons now. In fact, I think she's got a new sci-fi show, the Critters one, the sci-fi movie that they're doing.
Oh, cool.
I think she's in that. But so I was studying with her, and I got a day job because I wanted to stay in town. I didn't want to, because you couldn't make money in LA doing stand-up. You could only just go and do showcases and hope someone sees you and all that stuff. But to make money, you had to leave town. But if you leave town, you're not around to do auditions. So it just kind of segued that, and I kind of felt more out of stand-up, and I got more into acting. And then finally, like in I started maybe around 2007 2008, I started getting TV auditions for like That 70s Show and shows like that. And then around 2011 I booked The Middle on ABC, and I got I got a guest star booking on that. The designations, I don't know if you know this in acting, there's co-star, which is usually like a smaller part.
Okay.
Then there's guest star, which is a bigger part and more money. And then there's series regular or recurring. Recurring could be a co-star or a guest star that's on more than one episode. That it, you could still be a co-star but be recurring. So I booked a guest star part that was originally a co-star part, but because I interact with everybody in the cast and I'm in so much of the episode, they bumped me up to a guest star. So that kind of helped me. Yeah, kind of helped me get things started a little.
So you're in the middle was a fun show too.
It was a great show, and it was one of those rare shows that actually got better as it went along. I don't think it ever got the acclaim that it probably deserved because it was very middle America, white, you know, lower middle class family and stuff. It wasn't a very sexy show, but it was a really great show. It had great heart to it. Really
easily
fun.
Digestible too.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Really well drawn characters.
So from there, the looking at the IMDb here just to see if I make sure I don't miss anything. Anger Management. It was a fun show. Talk about your getting on there.
Yeah, same casting director as The Middle, and they brought me in, and it was an interesting story. And I use this, and I teach two classes actually about for audition techniques and stuff. I do them on Mondays and Wednesdays, and I use the story a lot that I went in for them originally, and the part I went in for was. This trivia host who was taking bribes from people in the audience. And he was kind of like sleazy. He was a little sleazy character.
Yeah.
And I did it and I got laughs. And the showrunner, who was the showrunner for the Drew Carey show, I can't think what his name is now. Bruce Helford. And he said, he goes, that was really funny. He goes, you're not this guy though. You're nice. You're the nice guy. And I was like, oh, okay. And then 2 weeks later, I got brought in, and the role was like a nice guy. And I booked it. So I use that as an example with actors. And I think, it would be a great example for wrestlers. You really got to – you have an essence. There's a you that walks into the room. And if you're trying to play at something else, you're not usually going to book that part. You're going to book the part that you can bring yourself to, you know. And then this part was great. It was – the episode is called Charlie and the Hit and Run. Martin Sheen. On my birthday, I got to do a table read on the soundstage with Charlie Sheen and Martin Sheen.
Oh, man.
That was pretty wonderful. And Charlie Sheen was super nice, by the way. Really, really nice guy. Like, incredibly nice. And the part was Martin Sheen hits my mom with a car, his old lady. And he tries to hide his money because he doesn't want to get sued. So he's giving everybody checks in the family so he can hide his money under the gift limit. So then Charlie finds out and he goes to tell the family what happened, and I'm the son. So I open the door and I have a big scene with him and Selma Blair.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And it was really funny because I met Charlie at the table read, but that was like a month before the shooting of the episode. And then what the day of it, I was sitting in my trailer for like from 9:30 to like 2:30, and then they're like, okay, we're ready for you, because that's really what you get paid for on a set, is to be ready when they need you and to sure. do it and then to go away. so just do it well, do it as many times as we need you to do it, now go away, please, thank you. And so the set was, you know, they knock on the door and I open it, and I didn't meet them that day on set until I opened the door in the scene, and then it's like, oh, there's Charlie Sheen and Selma Blair staring at me. I should probably say something.
Now, you talked about the grind of comedy. Acting has to be a bit of a grind as well.
It's a different grind. The grind of comedy is more the travel and the dealing with clubs and getting paid. And I once had a club owner tell me that comics need to manage their money better so they can allot for when he pays them late. So that's the kind of stuff you have to deal with. Yeah. So the grind in acting is more the waiting. You know, a lot. It's so nice now that you can do your own projects. The technology is a lot cheaper. One of the great things is everybody can make a movie. One of the bad things is everybody can make a movie.
Yeah.
But it does help you create content and stay working and meeting people and networking that way. Because if you're just sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, it's the worst, you know. And I always tell actors too, like, time passes differently for casting directors and producers and directors and agents even than it does for an actor. For an actor, it feels like, you know, you may not have seen someone in 3 years, a casting director, and they feel like they've just seen you 2 months ago, you know, because they're just going from project to project and working on this episode and getting that done and that turnaround. So that's where the grind's a little different. I actually really love auditioning. It's fun. I find it very fun. I find most of the, almost pretty much all the casting directors are on your side. They're rooting for you. They want you to do well. So it's just gets fun to get to act a fun scene at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday, you know?
So it's not as competitive, shitty, and, you know, dog eat dog as a business as it's portrayed to be.
No, I found stand up much more that way. Acting, I find very supportive. Because you're not really competing with people. One of the misnomers, or the misconceptions, I guess is probably a better word for it, is for acting is that if you have a great audition, you're going to book the part, and you can't control booking the part. There's a million reasons why you won't book it. You know, if you don't. It could just be that they had a uniform already and someone else fit it better, you know. So it's your job to go in and do a good job. So what you want is a session where five actors have a great audition, and then they just pick whatever particulars they're looking for or whatever. If everybody has a bad audition and you have a good audition, you're still not going to get the part because they won't be able to trust their judgment because there's nothing to gauge you against. So that's kind of one of the misconceptions, is that you're competing with people. You're kind of not. You just got to go in and do what you do. And then if you're right for it, you're right for it. That's great. There's a lot of times that you're not going to be right for that part, but then they'll bring you back for other parts that you are right for. Like what happened with me on Anger Management.
So it's a trust building thing more than anything.
Definitely. Yeah, you have to trust that the casting directors have your best interest at heart. You have to trust your agents are get you and are submitting you for the right parts. But then when you start getting into offices, really your job is to make the casting offices fans of you. You know, because they don't cast the projects. It's the producers, the showrunners, or the directors in film. They're the ones that cast the project. They just bring actors in to show them and give them choices, but the casting directors don't actually hire you specifically. Oh, they don't make the choice. They do hire you. They do give you the paperwork, but they don't make the choices.
I didn't even realize that. I figured just
the casting directors are making all the... Yeah, I know. A lot of people don't. Yeah.
One thing I have to ask about on here, just because the name is amazing, what is Vagenius's?
Oh, that was a short film I did. It was about these two women that were acting like total dude bros, and they were like picking up guys. So like the guys were the sex objects, and they were just total like dude bro guys picking up dudes and stuff like that. So it was pretty funny. It was a pretty funny short.
No, I got to know you in the last couple of years, and the one project that you are most proud of and should be is Concessionaires Must Die. You made your own movie, brother.
Yeah, that was, I mean, not just me. There was plenty of people involved. But yeah, no, I got a friend of mine, America Young, who's great. She's actually directing. She just went through the Warner Brothers directing program and completed it. And she's directing. Right now she's in Atlanta filming a Vampire Diaries spinoff series, Legacies, I believe it's called. Cool. And she just did an episode of Blind Spot. And so she's doing great. But we've been friends since we did a pilot presentation back in 2010 with Josh Brenner, another friend of mine who's on Silicon Valley, Big Head. He plays Big Head on Silicon Valley. If anybody watches that show, sure. I mean, plenty of people watch that show. But if you watch it, so we all kept in touch through that. She had this script that she wanted to work on and recraft it a little. And she wanted me to play the projectionist in it. It's set in a movie theater. It's basically the elevator pitch of it is it's Empire Records in a movie theater. It's like the dying days of a single screen movie theater that's going out of business. And then she wanted me to play the projectionist, and then asked me if I would be interested in rewrite, you know, in recrafting the script with her, doing a rewrite on it with her. So her and I took the script, which was already, everything was already there, you know, and I just, I added, punched up some jokes and stuff, and we changed some characterizations around, and just kind of really got the story really tight. And then it was just like a couple years process of trying to get funding, and we got some people involved, and then she got Stan Lee involved, who has a small part in the movie. He plays the lead character, who's David Blue, who's from Stargate Universe, plays his grandfather in a flashback. Dan Loria is in it from,
such a cool
from
cameo,
the Wonder Years.
Yeah, such a cool cameo.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's, and he was great. And I got to write that scene, which was so great. I think I did. Maybe I did. Maybe America wrote it. I thought I know we talked about it and worked it out. I don't want to take credit for it, but it was just like just having him say words that like I know that we worked on was just like amazing. So that was awesome. And then yeah, we got it filmed. We filmed it for 3 weeks in Fresno, California, in 2013, and we filmed at the movie theater pretty much the entire time. They gave it to us for like it's a landmark up there, and they gave it to us for like $50 a day plus electricity.
Oh, cool!
Which is insane. And we were live streaming the filming of a lot of the movie. We didn't do the last like 20 minutes of the movie, but like when we were filming stuff that was in the beginning of the movie and stuff, we would turn on like the webcam for like 2 hours, and we had someone hosting it, and like the actors or the crew, they'd come in and do interviews with people. And we got we got Quiznos catered our craft services a bunch from that. And Ari Alexa gave us use of the camera for free, and the Ari Alexa camera is like a big, like that's, they shot Avengers on that. Like it's a great camera. It's like, if you look that up online, it's like a big deal. It looked like just the raw footage out of the camera without any color correction looked gorgeous. Like it just looked amazing. So we got that for free. You know, America was a stunt woman for a long time, and as a stunt coordinator as well. And she got use of a crane for a couple of days when we filmed in downtown LA. So we filmed it. We filmed that big chunk, and then over the course of the next year, we did some pickups and stuff. Greg Aronowitz, who's a great special effects guy, worked on like 20 Spielberg movies, did all the little movie inserts for us. We do a lot of cutaways to like movie parody kind of stuff in the movie, and he did all the set designs and production designs for those for us for nothing. Just a lot of people got involved and helped us get it done. And the sound design people at Fake over in North Hollywood, they were great. They did it on deferment. Yeah, it was just great. We just had so much help. And then in 2017, we got into the Palm Springs International Film Festival, which is it's not quite like Sundance South by Southwest. It's like the next tier down. It's like top of the next tier down. So that was a big deal. And we sold out 2 screenings of that. So we ended up with 4 screenings.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, and we got really great reception, and we got a distributor, Dauntless, out of that. And a year after that, we were on VOD, which it still is now. It's on iTunes and Amazon, if anybody wants to check it out. And also, then a year after that, we did director and cast and crew commentary, and they released it on Blu-ray. And you can buy the Blu-ray of it on Amazon. It's in Best Buy, which is amazing to me. This little movie that was, you know, that was made on a shoestring budget.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, and that have a huge part. Yeah, a big part in it, but just the fact that it got made and it's, you know, and I know that the distributor has like a plan, like a plan for this movie that they really see it as, oh, this, they really see it as a potential like cult classic, you know, that it could get to that point of it. So they love it, and they're thrilled with the success of it, and they're going to keep pushing it, you know. So really what, wonderful.
What's the
really
mindset? Fortunate with it. What's the mindset change? Because you went into it, you know, as an actor all these times, and you know, here you are creating a movie. How do you switch your brain, you know, from one compartment to the other?
Well, luckily during the filming of it, I was just an actor, mm-hmm. so I didn't have to worry too much about the production stuff. I mean, I still did. I still showed up on days on set that I wasn't working, just because I love it. I love being on a set. It's such a great atmosphere, or it can be. I think that's why I enjoy acting more than I did stand up, at least the world of it, because I like being a part of something bigger, you know, like being a part of that and just seeing how how many people, and we had a good sized crew. We had about like 20 or 30 people as a crew, you know, so we had a considerable crew. So, but America was great and let me just work on the acting and focus on that. And then if I was watching other scenes and stuff, we would just, you know, we would toss lines back and forth if something needed to be punched up or something like that or whatever. But it was really nice. It was great being on location and just getting up and having nothing to worry about that day except going to make a movie. It's seriously the best feeling ever. It's just so great. Like, oh, we get to go make a movie today.
That's
all, you know, there's a great line in
that's the dream that everybody moves out to LA for too.
Yeah, you know, there was the movie The Rookie with Dennis Quaid, the baseball movie. He rediscovers his passion for it, and he comes in the locker room. He's like, you know what we get today? You know what we get to do today? We get to play baseball. And it's like, that's how I felt like every day getting up. Like, oh, I get to drive from the very scary hotel that we were staying at to downtown Fresno and dealing with the trains going by and all the noise and just going to make a movie and then just being around that for 3 weeks. For two or three weeks was so fun and so you know, stressful at times, but it's like the worst day. My worst day in acting is better than my best day at a day job that I've ever had, you know.
So any other projects like that coming up that you can talk about, or give you the bug to produce things, or?
Yeah, well, I have another script that I wrote about my sister and my dad and me. That I've gotten some interest in, that America wants to direct it as well. She really enjoys it as well. It's like a dramedy, and so that's what I'm looking for. If anybody knows any angel investors and wants to get involved, I already have some people attached to it. Kim Rhodes, who is a recurring character on Supernatural. She's a friend of mine. She wants to play my sister and stuff, and she's wonderful. So that's like what I would love to do next. I just shot an episode of Diary of a Female President for Disney Plus. It's Gina Rodriguez's new show. So I think that comes out in like 2020. So yeah, cool. So that's it now. And then
and just, you're teaching,
you know, yeah. And I teach an audition technique class.
You're giving back.
I love it. I really love it. And I coach actors on auditions as well. I really enjoy it. It's often the highlight of my week is doing the classes. I do one on Mondays at 11 a.m. and one on Wednesdays at 7 p.m.
And yet through all this, you still stayed a crazy wrestling fan as well.
I do. And I still, you know, because it does give me a lot of free time to be on Twitter. So that's all. much to my own detriment.
And yet you chose wrestling Twitter out of all of the subgenres of Twitter to be on for God knows what
reason. But again, you know, wrestling Twitter got me to SCI and it's got true. We all got to hang out and meet finally. And you know, and now my wife loves going, Amber loves going. So it's like family reunion now. It's really great. You know, so I can't really complain too much about wrestling Twitter.
It has more good days than bad days. I'll just say that.
Yes. Yeah. There you go. That's a great way to put it.
Well, John, anything else you want to plug? We'll wrap this up in a second here, but what else?
If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can follow me. My main actory account is at Jay Keats, JKEATS, and if you want to follow my wrestling stuff, all my hot spicy takes on the wrestling.
It's a great follow.
Wrestling. thank you. I'm a big fan of old school wrestling, so you get a lot of that talk, and that's The Great Bolo, which is an old school wrestler. So there you go. If you check out Concessionaires Must Die on either the Blu-ray or iTunes or Amazon streaming, and let me know. Drop a nice review if you like it. If you didn't like it, keep that shit to yourself.
Well, John, thank you so much. You're a great friend, and you're a fascinating human being, and I can't wait to see you next year. I'm trying to get you out to Mania. That's a goal.
That one might be a little too much for even me. That might be.
I'll definitely see you at SEI, and
will see me at SEI.
The rumored WrestleMania in Los Angeles happens, I'll be trying to sleep on your floor. So.
Well, there you go. Yeah, we have an extra room, so you're all set.
All right, buddy. Great talking to you, my friend.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much. You.
Over in the Place to Be Nation pop feed, first check out our weekly shows. The hard-traveling fanboys continue their annual Walking Dead month with guest Jennifer Smith as they count down the worst episodes in TV show's history. Scott continues his look at the classic Universal Monsters in the latest episode of Pop Goes the Classic with the 1933's Invisible Man. DC4U continues DC Comics' best horror offering. We review in 2019 Swamp Thing pilot. His week in the NFL hits as well, with Roger and Johnny recapping the last set of games and previewing the upcoming weekend's batch. Siblings Kevin and Mary host the Brother and Sister Rewatch. On episode 20, they bring you The Office, season 3, episodes 11 and 12. On Sunday Groove, David welcomes Tim Capel back to the show to discuss the 80s song tournament and other 80s music they love. Andy Scott, Dr. G, and John DeMatter are back with the Year in Pop, where they discuss the sports news and pop culture of 1978. Pop Goes the Movies looks at the controversial Joker film. John DeMatter and Andy look at DC's latest. The NBA team is back with Adam and Andrew to provide a slew of team previews to the upcoming season. JT and Leanne are here with an emergency Pop Goes the Couch, talking Jersey Shore, including Ron Ron's arrest, Jenny being shitty, and more. The greatest song of the 80s tournament is concluded with Sweet Child of Mine, Guns N' Roses being crowned the champion. We're excited to announce the greatest sitcom tournament. Stay tuned to our social media for updates, so that should be fun. Check out a brand new podcast feed brought to you by our own Jennifer Smith. The Jenny Position can be found on Podbean, iTunes, and your favorite podcatcher app. It'll be the new home of Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, Freak Out Driving, and lots of other fun new content. For the month of October, Place to Be Nation is holding our first annual Halloween movie challenge. We're giving you suggestions on what movies to watch leading up to All Hallows Eve. We need to go on social media and let us know using the hashtag PTBN Halloween Movie Challenge. But don't stop there. Every time you watch a scary or silly horror movie, you're special. It will add to the list. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, Chris and Devin are back to break down the latest WWE pay-per-view, Hell in a Cell, on the Instant Reaction Show. On the Place to Be podcast, JT and Scott and guest Todd Weber kick off a whole new decade of pay-per-views, the Royal Rumble 1990. On the latest PTBN Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, John, and Jenny continue the latest ECW adventure with When Worlds Collide. On Main Event 135, Scott, Nate, and Steve welcome Jordan Duncan to talk about the past 2 weeks of programming, including AEW, NXT, and SmackDown. And it's October Guest Fest on Row 1, Seat 1, as I brought on a slew of guests, including Warhorse, Excite Wrestling. I brought on a lot of people. It was a fun show. You should really check it out. Don't forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com each day. We have new voices and fresh takes, bringing you articles and topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports, and pop culture. But don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn's Weekly Walk on every Wednesday, Scott Cascarlo and Logan Crossan's Campus Hot Takes, looking at college football every Tuesday afternoon. And if you're doing online shopping at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of Place to Be Nation and use PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon. Take you right to Amazon and help us out with no cost to you. Check out our social media pages and message boards at Biglow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWE pay-per-view and TV match-over project, and get in the conversation today and start researching your lists.